Hello and welcome in.
First Science Mixtape.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. It is indeed Saturday morning. It is super sunny and lovely, and just you should get on down and out into Soho. Come see us, come and say hi. We have got a packed show coming up for you today, and it's going to be all about the weather. Yes. The weather is good at the moment, but it is not always. And we are going to be finding out how it works, why all those weird weather patterns happen, and what Matt Hay, weather forecaster extraordinaire's favourite type of weather is. So yeah, my guest today is Matthew Hay. He is an Arctic explorer, a couple of times at least, and a weather fanatic, training to be a forecaster with the Met Office. Good morning, Matthew.
Good morning.
And joining us as a guest producer, we have Anna Wegulin as well.
Good morning. Hello.
Particularly excited to have Anna here today because she does a fantastic beaver impression. And I don't know if anyone else saw, but beavers have given birth for the first time in England in centuries, recolonising the lands.
I'd like to see Anna's beaver impression. I don't think I've ever been privy to this.
Yes, you have at the triathlon.
Oh, was that it?
I think so.
Yep. But anyway, moving swiftly on, we have got our weekly brain teaser slash riddle for you. So, thinking caps on, there was a ship that sank in perfect weather. If the weather had been worse, the ship probably would not have sank. What was the ship and what happened? If you think you know the answer, you can tweet us at Soho Radio. And there's one other thing I want you to tweet about today as well. And that is that coming up next week on the 30th of June at midnight, we are going to have a leap second. So I want to know what you're going to do with your extra second. So you could tweet us that as well, please. And Matthew and Anna, I will be asking you later in the show, so get your thinking caps on. But now, without further ado, could we please have Matthew introduce us to your first song of the day?
Yeah, so my first song's by Arcade Fire. It's called City With No Children In. Not a huge amount to say about it. It's just a really cracking listen, and I really enjoy it.
Great, let's start the show.
There was no light that we could see as we listened to the sound of the engine failing.
Start to the morning. I realised that I forgot to say, for our weekly science experiment, if you want to play along, we are going to be making a cloud in a bottle. And all you will need is a large bottle, 2 litres or 1 litre is recommended, a little bit of water, warm is best, and some matches. So if you're a child, please get an adult to help you with those matches. And that will be coming up halfway through the show. But for now, we're moving smoothly into our science news. Okay. Sorry, Matthew just looked at me like he was going to say something, so I paused.
False alarm.
Yeah, false alarm. Obviously, it's Pride this weekend, so really excitingly, there is actually some Pride-related science news, and there's been a new study published that has been looking into the sort of social effects of same-sex marriages on children and same-sex parenting, and they have decided there's a consensus that there is no significant different effects from having same-sex parents as heterosexual parents. So that is awesome and great news. And it's going to be used, well, it's sort of great to have this scientific database to be pulled up in courts and things, because a lot of the issues around do we want to approve same-sex marriage was looking at, well, what would be the effects on children and families? And no different effects. So that's great.
That's great news, isn't it?
Full steam ahead.
The science is backing it up.
Indeed. What science news have you brought with us today?
Yeah, so I've got two bits of science news. They're both weather-related, which is probably unsurprising. The first is about Tropical Depression Bill, which actually, interestingly, was affecting our weather only yesterday.
Ooh, in what way?
Well, bringing that horribly humid, muggy, tropical maritime air. That was all ex-Tropical Depression Bill. He got involved with a big weather system out in the Atlantic and slowly chuffed his way towards us. But the main bit of news I wanted to say is that actually Tropical Depression Bill brought enormous amounts of rain to the US, and this was due to something called the Brown Ocean Effect. So, Tilda, you know, you're an amateur weather enthusiast. What do you think this is about? What do hurricanes need to get going?
Okay, so hurricanes need... They tend to happen over the sea, as far as I understand, and they need warm water, or like warm air currents rising off the sea, and they need some wind. Am I at all close?
Yeah, you are close. So definitely. So they need a feed of energy, and the energy comes from warm water, effectively. I think the critical temperature you need to have a hurricane is water that is 26.5 degrees Celsius or more over a depth of ocean that is 150 feet deep or more. So that's basically limits you to the tropical seas. You're also interesting.
Are they actually that warm? I don't think a sea's actually like 26 degrees warm.
Oh, yeah. Seas get up to like 28, 29. Yeah, see, the tropical
just
seas.
Just at the surface,
like,
right?
A bath, isn't it?
Oh, wow.
Well, 150 feet deep. That's 50 metres. That's deeper than you'd dive. It's pretty nice.
Huh.
You also, I don't know if you've heard this, you can't get hurricanes forming on the equator.
I have not heard this.
And this is because, well, for any storm, you need some sort of rotation, don't you? And to get rotation on the Earth, you need the Coriolis effect. And the Coriolis effect is effectively zero when you're on the equator. So you actually need...
What is the Coriolis effect? Is it to do with, like, wind and spinning?
The Coriolis effect, if you really want to get stuck into this, look it up. It's quite a complex physical idea. It's all to do with things known as frames of reference. And because the Earth is a spinning object, we have to view it from a rotating frame of reference, and this gives rise to pseudo forces, of which the Coriolis effect is one.
So, like, fake forces?
Well, yes, fake in that you can't see them from some frames of reference, but real in that they have real effects on the world we know. So, for example, why do storms?
It
is kind of spooky, isn't it? Like, why do storms spin one way in the northern hemisphere and the other way in the southern hemisphere? And it's because the Coriolis pushes to the right in the northern hemisphere and to the left in the southern hemisphere. But all hurricanes, all storms, they basically need to spin. That's that vorticity helps with the uplift of the air, and that uplift is what gives you the condensation into clouds and moisture. And because of this, they can't form on the equator. But anyway, I'm digressing. So Tropical Depression Bill was the second named tropical storm in this year's Atlantic hurricane season.
I do like how they name them.
Yeah, they do. They tend to go down the alphabet, and since I think, well, since there was some kind of general outcry that they were all named after men, they started alternating male and female names. So you might start with Anna and then Bill and then Catherine and then David and so on and so forth. And actually, you get different types of tropical storms all over the world, and the different national meteorological agencies take great pride in naming the storms in their regions, which I think is slightly weird. I wouldn't really want to have anything to do with a storm that's about to ruin my country, but
you
to each their own.
You told me an amazing fact the other day, which is that the American storms that are named after girls are taken less seriously. Is that true?
Yeah, it is. It's actually a really terrible fact. So statistically, female-named hurricanes do more damage in the Caribbean and the United States of America. America. And the reason for this, they think is shocking. It's simply because, I don't want to generalise, but you know, you get people in the southern states, let's call them hicks, and they hear that a female storm is coming and they don't take it as seriously. They think, oh, Hurricane Bertha, she's not going to be as badass as Hurricane Abraham, so I'm not going to take myself inside. I'm not going to shutter down my windows. I'm not going to put sandbags out of my house. And then guess what? Your house gets blown away by Hurricane Bertha.
Oh, my God.
And the damage ends up being much greater. So, yeah, absolutely ridiculous fact, but just... Just reflecting some interesting things about the American psyche, I think.
Yeah, definitely. But anyway, this one was called Bill, so I'm sure he was taken very seriously.
Yeah, this one was called Bill. He wasn't actually a hurricane, he was only a tropical storm. So the focus with Bill was never really on the winds. He was never really packing a punch with winds. It was on the amount of rain he was bringing. So I don't know if you know, but Texas has been, and a lot of the southern states, have been suffering from severe drought for the last couple of years. And it's getting to almost historical, it almost was getting to historical levels of water shortage. And then they had a record wet May just the last month that's just gone, and that brought torrential flooding, and now they've basically gone from being in crippling drought to having no drought. And all the moisture from that record-breaking May sat over the southern states. The ground was absolutely saturated, rivers were swollen, there was extensive flooding, there was lots of water on the floodplains. And and what all this extra moisture meant is that tropical storm Bill, when he made landfall, didn't weaken as much as you'd expect, because his supply of moisture was still there, and that the heat as well from the southern states in the summer, these are very
warm
places.
It's a brown ocean because it's
brown ocean because it's the land.
On land.
Exactly. So he didn't weaken nearly as much, and all that moisture was available for him to keep evaporating up and keep himself going. So he was able to dump absolutely phenomenal amounts of rain over Texas. And then I think he went north towards Oklahoma and Arkansas. And
wreaking havoc.
Absolutely. I mean, honestly, dumping so much water. I mean, hundreds of mils of water in just a day, which, you know, in the UK, maybe the wettest day we ever experienced, we get an inch, which is what, I don't know, 200.
We only get an inch.
Yeah, which is what, like 23 mils? So when we're talking about hundreds of mils being dumped, you're looking instantly at flooding and
all kinds of carnage. Is that like being in a waterfall all day?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, yeah, like being in a shower.
Wow. So, yeah, I can understand why Tropical Storm Bill has made the news.
He was badass.
Another piece of science news, which is also weather-related, go me. It's kind of weather-related. You're probably going to correct me right now. It's actually about climate change.
Very important. Don't get those two confused.
Do you want to give a quick distinction? What's the difference between climate and weather?
Climate is effectively the long-term normal, or the long-term average weather conditions you'd expect to see over a region. So when we're talking about climate, we're really talking about the weather over a region for 30 years or more.
Okay.
Weather obviously happens day to day, changes day to day. You can have a hot week. That doesn't mean you have a hot climate. Your climate is over 30 years. So you need to have that hot weather lasting a long time before you can start affecting the climate.
Excellent. Thank you. Very explained. Very well explained, I should say. So anyway, this is all about the fact that there's been a historic case in the courts of Netherlands saying that the government could be sued for not doing enough towards cutting greenhouse emissions. They were aiming to cut greenhouse emissions by 17% by 2020, and the court has ordered that they must cut it by 25% by 2020, because all governments have a legal duty to protect their citizens from harm, and therefore they must do their most to prevent global warming, as this could be seen to harm citizens because it's going to have catastrophic effects. And the reason this case is so interesting is because in the past people have tried to sort of have lawsuits about global warming and climate change, but it's always been kind of looking backwards. It's like, let's sue some oil companies because what they've done is now like eroding our coast where our houses are, and we've got to move our houses. But you can't pin global warming and climate change on a few companies. It's, you know, a lot of effects and a lot of different things coming together. However, looking forwards, if the governments are deemed to have not done enough, then they could be facing legal action. And this is like, so it's happened in the Netherlands now, this has now been passed, and it's something that they think might be coming to the UK and a lot of other EU countries. I mean, obviously every country's legal system's different, but the premise of governments have a duty of care to their citizens, and that duty of care is to do their best to prevent global warming and climate change.
Yeah, this is really, this news is really great, I think, because, well, the Dutch are always quite forward thinking, aren't they? Always,
yeah,
slightly ahead of the curve in terms of these things. But it hopefully sets a precedent that other developed and less developed countries will follow as well, of realising that we do need to look forward,
we need to plan ahead, prioritise it, yeah.
And governments need to take this seriously. And it's something that a lot of people want, you know, these days. Yes, there will be costs to big businesses and maybe to the economy, but if you plan ahead, you're always going to be able to manage it best, aren't you? So I'm very pleased the Dutch are doing this.
Go them. And actually, one of the questions that we got asked by our listeners is climate change responsible for all the weird and wacky weather that we've been having recently? I mean, there's been a lot of talk in the last couple of years about extreme weather conditions caused by climate change.
Yeah, it's really, really difficult to tease this out. I actually, when I was in my last year at university, I did a whole dissertation on trying to tease out the difference between extreme weather that's the cause of natural variability and extreme weather that's the cause of climate change. The other confounding factor you've got to add in is that we have far more extensive media communications, satellite networks now than we ever did before. So perhaps we're just more aware. Perhaps now we can see the Arctic ice thinning. We can see these huge storms forming over the middle of the Pacific Ocean
that we just weren't aware of before.
And people talk about it more. People tweet about it. It gets hyped. You get weather bombs. It gets sensationalized. But having said all of that, and I do think that is a factor, I do think that is a reason why people are believing that there's more extreme weather going on. I do think it is likely that our climate variability has increased. You just have to look at how many records, even in the UK, how many records are being broken every year, both hot and cold.
Yeah, sort of a record cold winter or a record hot summer or a record wet
and
month.
I think the frequency of these things is higher than it would be if we didn't have some kind of larger climate change going on behind the natural variability.
Interesting. good to have the skeptical eye, though. Thank you. And your final piece of science news.
Yeah, well, this is just a bit of fun, really. Something that's pretty close to my heart. I am a very keen Scottish skier. So there are five there are five ski centres in Scotland.
Would you believe it?
Yeah, would you believe it? You know, they top out on our tiny hills at altitudes lower than the base of most alpine ski resorts. But they're great fun. They're a bit of a joke. The runs are about 10 metres wide and sometimes only about 30 metres long. You're often skiing into a gale with sleet in your face. But on the right day, with the right people, it's just an immense amount of fun. But my point this year was that Glencoe and the Nevis Range, two of the resorts that are on the west coast in the Western Highlands, they spun their lifts on the 21st of June, which is the summer solstice, which is midsummer day, because they had sufficient snow to let people still ski on their resorts.
People were skiing in Scotland on the summer solstice.
Yeah, it's nuts, but you know, this happens every year. There are parts of the Highlands where you know, the snow piles up through the winter. You've got to remember, it's a different climate up there, and the winds drive the snow in, and the snow packs down into river gullies and onto the sheltered aspects of the mountains, and it can build up into enormous patches that last throughout the summer. There are some snow patches in the Highlands that rarely melt at all. I think there's one mountain that's only melted three times in the last century, and wow. guess what? It's melted twice since 2000.
There's extreme variability.
Yeah, it's so cool. And you know, I was skiing with some friends up in Glencoe at the start of May, and they just had a big fresh dump of snow, and they could claim literally to be the resort with the most powder in the world, because you know, by May most of the resorts in France and Italy and Austria, they're not getting any snow anymore. It's too hot. And also the season down south in New Zealand and Argentina hasn't really kicked off because it's still just later autumn down there. So Glencoe was
so
maxing out.
If you fancy some summer skiing, Scotland is the place to go.
Yeah, and it's pretty cool. I would definitely recommend it if you get the chance. Pick a day when the wind isn't too strong, which is easier said than done, and just go and have a laugh, because it's absolutely great fun.
I've been as well. It is really fun. You do only have about four runs, maybe six on a good day.
Oh, don't expect any good food either. It's very much a deep fried something, probably some chips and some iron brew to wash it down.
We're going to come back to snow, because I know it's a little pet favourite thing of yours, Matthew, but before we do that, what is your next song?
My next song is a short one, and actually it's by a Scottish band, Biffy Clyro. It's called Who's Got a Match. How do you capture a photograph? Put it to sleep, pretend you're having a laugh. I know you thought you'd have the last.
And now from the hot to the very cold. Matthew, you told me once that your favourite type of weather is a blizzard. This seems quite implausible. Why is your favourite weather a blizzard? I can think of nothing more unpleasant, except maybe be a blizzard when you're in the water.
Why a blizzard? I really like snow. Blizzards are quite unusual in this country. In fact, very unusual. You very rarely get a blizzard unless you're up in the mountains, really. I mean, I probably wouldn't want to be in a blizzard the whole time, and I'm sure if a blizzard happened every day, I'd very quickly tire of it, and it would be my favourite weather. But when it does happen, it's pretty exciting. You know, it makes you feel like you're out there, and things are getting pretty gnarly, and it's just quite fun.
So what is it about snow that really fascinates you? Because you've said that snow is and cold weather is what got you into the weather in the first place.
Yeah, I've always absolutely loved it. I've loved cold weather. I've loved snow. I've thought about this quite a lot, and I'm not really sure. You know, there's obviously the childish element of snow. It's fun. It's nice to roll into balls and throw at people. It's fun to go sledging. I love skiing. It's also unusual, and maybe that's part of the appeal to it. But I think, and this is going to sound really pretentious, but I think, and this is part of the reason why I really like the weather. And you can, you know, you can look up at the sky every day, and you can see the clouds racing across with the wind. And when snow falls, this is a much bigger manifestation of this. But it's a real sign of the bigger natural world out there, and its ability to do whatever it wants, regardless of what humans are doing. So, you know, we sit here and we build our cities and we drive around in our cars, and if the weather feels like it, it can dump a foot of snow on us and wreak absolute havoc. And the way that snow can completely change a landscape, completely change the feeling of a scene or
a
region.
Yeah, that's true. Snow-covered scene.
You know, there's nothing quite like it. You can get up there early in a winter's morning and the snow's lying there, and you get that silence, and it just looks completely desolate, completely calm, completely different.
I have to say, listeners, this is a person who likes to check the webcams on the Cairngorm Range for fun, just to check out the snow up in Scotland.
Oh, every day. I love it. Yeah, no, I absolutely love it, and I just think when the world is cloaked in snow, it's just a very special thing to witness.
And in terms of sort of, I mean, you're often predicting when it's going to snow, what the snow is going to be like. How easy is that? Easy? Is that difficult?
It's very difficult predicting snow, particularly in the UK. You know, if we were in Siberia and it got past November, I could tell you that any precipitation that falls is almost certainly going to be snow, because the air temperature is so cold that's what it's going to have to be. But in the UK, obviously, we're on the edge of an ocean and also a continental landmass, and we're basically at a juxtaposition of loads of different air masses, and we get all weather types as those air masses bump into each other. And trying to forecast snow when conditions are marginal is incredibly difficult, because the difference of, you know, half a degree, a couple of hundred meters of altitude can make the difference between snow and rain, or snow that falls and snow that settles on the ground.
And why is that? So what are the conditions that you need for snow?
Well, you need cold air. You need precipitation to be falling in temperatures below freezing, because otherwise it'll melt and turn into rain. You need ground temperatures to not be excessively warm. The ground temperatures can cool quite quickly if the snowfall is heavy enough. And actually, there's a process called evaporative cooling, where if snow continues to fall for a long time, due to the latent heat of evaporation, it effectively takes heat out of the air and cools the air down, and then snow can fall to progressively lower levels. So you sometimes hear about this: if snow persists for ages, it'll start higher up the mountain and slowly it'll lower until it's right down at the valley bottom, and then there'll be a big dump of snow down there. But you need to look at something called your dew point, and your dew point is a measure of the humidity of the air. And usually if your dew point is below freezing and it is snowing, the snow has a good chance of settling.
And why would hail form instead of snow? So I get that snow is like crystallized water, so ice crystals in like nice little flakes, and hail is just an icy ball.
Yeah, so most of our precipitation starts off as snow. If you think in the clouds, often the tops of the clouds, the temperatures there are well below freezing. And as moisture condenses up there, it tends to crystallize into a solid form and into snow. Hail is slightly different. Hail can only form in what we call convective clouds. Convective clouds are the lumpy bumpy ones, and you need a fairly serious convective cloud with enough depth to have the strength of convection to form hail, because what happens is the convection, which is effectively a circular updraft and downdraft, during the updraft and downdraft process,
and this is air we're talking about, so air being pulled up and then circling around, yes,
air circulating around, and that pulls the condensing moisture around as well. And if the temperature is below freezing, those frozen bits of moisture will collide with each other in a process known as accretion, and as they collide with each other, they form little balls of ice. And as the ice continues to go up and down and hit other balls of ice, it grows and grows and grows, which is why the size of the hail
is making a snowman in a cloud.
Yeah, almost. Yeah, exactly.
When you roll the ball and it gathers.
Except you've got to imagine that it's like having two snowballs, one in each hand, and smashing them together to make a bigger snowball. That's kind of what you're doing. And the stronger the convection, so the bigger the cloud, the stronger the convection, the larger the hailstone that can be sustained. Because you can imagine that these balls smash together until the hailstone is sufficiently large that it's so heavy that the convective updraft can't keep it in the sky and it falls to Earth. Which is why in America, when you get those enormous supercell storms with massive convective clouds and massive convective updrafts, they can sustain hailstones the size of golf balls, the size of tennis balls, sometimes even bigger than that, smashing together before they eventually drop to the...
I would not want to be there when they fell.
No. And actually, that's some of those in tropical regions, hailstorms are some of the worst, the most damaging weather types you can get, because they absolutely decimate crops and agriculture, and they can kill livestock.
Yeah, imagine being like a cow, just like chilling in a field, and this golf-sized hail starts raining on your head.
It's game over. It's... You've had your time if you're that cow. So it's an absolute disaster for farmers in lots of parts of the world where you get strong convection.
That is fascinating. I always thought it was to do with how quickly it cooled down. I was like, oh, if it cools slowly, it's going to be snowflakes, and if it cools fast, it's going to be a hail. No.
Well, no, but I mean, that's why you often get hail in the summer. You know, you wouldn't really ever think about getting snow in the summer, not unless you're on top of a mountain in Scotland. But you can get hail in the summer, and that's because there's more heat, there's more energy for those convective updrafts, and at the tops of the clouds, you're still below freezing. And it's all about the convective updraft.
And we are going to be talking much more about clouds after our next song. If you are listening, we'll be doing our experiment of making a cloud in a bottle. So stay tuned. Make sure you've got your bottle, a little bit of water, and some matches. And if you are a child, have a parent to light your matches for you, please. Well, what is our next song going to be, Matthew?
Yeah, this next song is it's called Play. It's by a Norwegian band called Flunk. It's quite chilled. I first heard it when I used to watch The OC when I was much younger.
Love The OC.
Love The OC. Classic show. Really enjoyed it. And yeah, it's just a very chilled song, quite a feel-good song, a nice listen.
It's a soothing delight. Yes, indeed it is. If you've just tuned in, our weekly riddle, if you've just tuned in, this show is all weather themed. So our weekly riddle is, a ship sank in perfect weather. If the weather had not been perfect, it probably would not have sank. What happened? And you are just in time for our weekly science experiment, where we are just going to be making a cloud in a bottle.
Woo-hoo!
So you need a bottle. I have a 1 litre one, and Matthew has a 2 litre one.
That's right, bigger is better.
And we're going to just pour in a little bit of warm water. So you probably want maybe like a centimetre at the bottom.
this sounds rather suspicious.
On And we're giving it a little shake just to get those water molecules going. And then, put the lid back on. And you want to squeeze your bottle nice and hard. So you are increasing the pressure inside the bottle. And let it go. And squeeze. And let it go. Has anything happened?
No, nothing.
Nothing really has happened. Now, when you're squeezing a bottle, you're increasing the pressure inside it. And that increases the temperature of the sort of gas. So we've got a little bit of vaporized water, and that temperature will increase when we put pressure in. And then when air cools, that is when you get a cloud. But we haven't got all the pieces that we need. So now it's time to take your matches. And what we're going to do is we're going to provide a little bit of smoke and dust into our bottle atmosphere. So you want to light your match and then just let it burn for a little bit inside your bottle. So I've just held it into the neck, and now I'm going to drop it.
It helps if you tilt your bottle onto the side as you're putting the match in. You can get a nice good bit of smoke in. Also, yeah. If your match is smoking rather than being a light, that's fine as well.
Yeah, you really just want a little bit of smoke, and quickly put your bottle cap on to trap that smoke. So we've got some dust and some smoke inside, which is more representative of our normal atmosphere. And you want to do the same. You want to squeeze it and let it go. And as you let it go, you should see a cloud just form. And when you squeeze it, that cloud disappears. And when you let it go, it's cloudy again. It is absolutely amazing. Matthew, you having fun there?
Yeah, mine's gone pretty well, actually. I'm pretty pleased with this.
Yeah, you should be able to do it sort of 5 to 10 times. And each time, your cloud should get cloudier. And every time you squeeze it, it still disappears. All right, I think, it's kind of hard to hear over the sound of that bottle.
Sorry, I'm getting a little overexcited.
All I know is that we've changed the pressure. And so when we squeeze it, we're warming the gas inside. And when we let it go, we're cooling, and clouds form when they cool. But Matthew, could you probably explain it a little bit more?
Yeah, so you need some basic ingredients for a cloud to form. Effectively, clouds form when air starts to rise, and as the air rises, it cools. Eventually, it cools to the point that it's saturated. It can't hold any more water vapor, and water vapor starts to condense out of it. But in order for the water vapor to condense out in the atmosphere, you need
something. And condensing
something
is when it becomes a liquid, right?
Yeah,
so it's going
sorry,
from
yeah,
a gas
it goes
to a liquid.
From water vapor to liquid water. And that moisture needs something to condense onto. We call these condensation nuclei. So every cloud will have cloud condensation nuclei at its heart. And that's what's allowed the process to start in the first place. And these nuclei can be anything. They can be dust. They can be grains of sand blown high into the atmosphere from
like
the Sahara.
A little bit. Like a little solid particle for the water to cling onto.
Exactly. Just like a tiny solid substance that the condensation process can occur on the surface of.
Ah.
And some substances are much better than others in terms of being cloud condensation nuclei. You can get loads of different types of condensation nuclei. But that's what you need. So what happens is we get the smoke and the ash and the dust from the match into the bottle atmosphere. That provides a source of cloud condensation nuclei.
Yeah,
and then once the atmosphere, we squeeze it to warm it, and then as we let it cool, and suddenly with these nuclei, the water can condense out into
it's really cool. It literally happens in, the snap of a fingers. There's no cloud, then there's a cloud. Brilliant. Clouds are pretty cool. There's a lot of different types, and Matthew, what would be your favourite type of cloud?
Oh, my favourite type of cloud. Clouds are really cool. And clouds are something that actually we don't know everything about. There's loads of research going on, but we fundamentally don't understand a lot of the processes that go on in clouds, and really interestingly we don't know how clouds may affect or may not affect climate change. There's research that suggests that clouds may be the key to stopping climate change if we can see more clouds and certain types of clouds, because they affect how much light is reflected back into the atmosphere.
Yeah, and if we reflected away the light from the sun, we might be cooling the planet. But then again, when you've got a cloudy night, it's warmer because it's trapping the heat and preventing it from escaping. So maybe actually more clouds will increase the greenhouse effect, who knows?
Yeah, but I'm dodging the question here. My favourite types of clouds, I've got several. The most amazing clouds, if you're near a computer or you have your phone and you have access to internet.
Or we will be tweeting it, yes.
Type in nacreous clouds, N-A-C-R-E-O-U-S. Nacreous clouds, they form high up in the atmosphere, above the troposphere, which is the part of the atmosphere we live in where all the weather happens. And these clouds are very rare. You can only see them in the summer at high latitudes.
So you've
places
got to be
far to the north or far to the south
near
of the equator.
North or south.
And they're what's known as iridescent, which means
They shine.
They shine with multicolours. They're incredibly trippy.
It
honestly,
sounds like Northern Lights.
You got to check them out. They look amazing. In terms of clouds that you're more likely to see, though, so some of my favourite include Altocumulus lenticularis, it's a very technical name, but the lenticularis, the Latin there meaning lens, because some people think they look like lens shapes. Personally, I feel like they look a bit more like UFOs, and often this is the most common reason why people
like flying saucers.
Or some people refer to them as stacks of plates. Again, they're definitely worth a Google, and they're the most common reason why people report sightings of UFOs, is because they've just seen Altocumulus lenticularis.
Is it like a cloud on its own, though, so it would look like one spaceship, or is there like a whole bunch of them? Like,
well, it depends.
An invasion is coming.
Sometimes it will look like you've literally got, as I say, plates stacked high, like maybe 10 or 15 plates stacked, whereas sometimes it just looks like you've got one, and they tend to be sort of wispy at the edges, which I guess gives them a slightly more ethereal like semblance. And yeah, exactly, very X-Files. So they're very cool, and if you live downwind of a mountain range, that's the best place to see those. They form under certain types of atmospheric conditions.
And what are the most common clouds that we would see like every day walking around London, walking around Soho?
Yeah, the most common clouds you see are the little fluffy fair weather cumulus clouds. So I quite like these as well. They're quite cute, they're quite picturesque. They definitely make a country scene photo.
The classic kind of cloud,
the classic little fluffy cloud.
And like a sheep in the sky.
And also they tend to, if you've only got small cumulus clouds like that, then it's a fairly good indication that you're not going to get any rain or bad weather, and that it's going to be quite a nice, bright and sunny day. So they're quite cheery.
So if we can see them in the sky, it's a good sign.
It's a very good sign, yes. The other clouds that you'll see a lot of are what I call cirrus clouds, and these are the very wispy, faint white clouds. And the reason they're wispy is because they form very high in the atmosphere, and so they're entirely ice crystal based. There's no liquid water in them at all. And actually, planes, you sometimes see behind planes what's known as
they've got like a wake in the sky.
Yeah, it's called a contrail, a condensation trail, and that's because planes, with all the exhaust that they pump out, they are effectively seeding clouds in the sky, and they're seeding cirrus clouds way up in the atmosphere. But cirrus, they tend to be very wispy, and you do often see them when the weather's fine. But if you start to see cirrus covering the whole sky progressively more and more, that's a bad sign. That's a sign that a weather front is on the way, and probably 3 to 6 hours after you see those clouds building in very high in the atmosphere, it's going to start raining wherever you are.
Ooh. Okay, we're going to come back to weather fronts and what they are in a little DIY forecasting session. But my favourite cloud fact is that some clouds can be like super violent and can destroy planes.
Yeah, so these are the cumulonimbus clouds, which again are quite well known by people who have an interest in clouds. They're the clouds that will give you all the extreme types of weather. If you ever have a hailstorm, if you ever have a thunderstorm, if you ever see a tornado or a funnel cloud or a waterspout, they're all going to have come out of cumulonimbus clouds. So these are convective clouds, but they're convective.
That we talked about before, so they've got that sort of cycle of air.
Exactly, they're drawing air up and down around them. But cumulonimbus clouds are when the convection is sufficiently great and covers a sufficient depth that you can really get some very powerful weather types going on.
Yeah, so I think it was in the news last year that a plane went missing, and everyone's like, oh, it's, you know, Malaysian Airways, it's just gone missing again. And yeah, someone said, no, it's just flown into a cloud and been chucked 4,000 feet in the sky. I didn't know that could happen.
Yeah, so cumulonimbus clouds are a huge risk to aviation, even to massive jumbo jets. You'd think a big plane, you can fly through a cumulonimbus cloud. No, not at all.
It's just a bit
there's hailstones in there, and the updrafts will often just pull the planes right up towards the stratosphere and chuck them out at the top and do them some real damage on the way. So always planes will be taking note of cumulonimbus clouds. And sometimes you can actually notice your pilot will be steering around those clouds because he's so reluctant to get involved in the updrafts. But much more terrifying is every so often someone who's parachuting or microlighting or paragliding or something like that ends up in a CB cloud. And they almost very nearly die, or they do die, because they get sucked way up to the top of the atmosphere where the temperatures are minus 50, minus 60 degrees.
Oh,
you can't breathe because there's no oxygen. You tend to pass out. And if you're lucky, the cloud will spit you out to the top and you'll fall back down. And sometimes your parachute is still working and you end up being okay, but almost always you'll be unconscious, you'll have hypothermia, you'll have some terrible frostbite, and it will have been one of the most frightening experiences of your life.
God, who knew clouds could be so deadly? Right, so we're going to have a little bit more music and then we will return to learn all about how forecasting actually works. What is our next song, Matthew?
Yeah, so the next song I want to play you all is Daddy's Gone by Glass Vegas, another Scottish band, and another cracking tune.
Daddy's Gone by Glass Vegas. Fantastic accent going on right there. So, before we go, while we have forecaster extraordinaire with us, I want to know, Matthew, how do you forecast the weather? Like, literally, how do you do it?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I find it really funny, because weather forecasting in this day and age is kind of a mix between the most advanced computing science you could possibly imagine, a bunch of empirical techniques from the 1960s. So these are just rules of thumb that people have, mathematical, statistical rules of thumb that people have come up with.
Can you give some examples?
Yeah, so you know, if you want to try and calculate the risk of fog, then you can draw a graph with your current temperature and your dew point, and you can draw a graph, and that'll give you the temperature at which fog is likely to form.
And that's pretty spot on?
And yeah, sometimes it works. I mean, you have to adapt it depending on where in the country you are and if you're in a valley and stuff, but it's basically trial and error has come up with these techniques. And then the last part is folklore. Genuinely, people still, you know, if the pressure's...
sky at night is shepherd's delight, all of that sort of thing.
If the pressure's dropping 3 hectopascals an hour, issue a gale. It's just, you know, just there are these. It's just this weird juxtaposition of really advanced science and just kind of know-how from ages old.
Amazing. And so a lot of people, you know, give forecasters a lot of stick because the weather, you know, the weather always changes and they never really know and they're always wrong. Why is it so hard to predict the weather?
It's very, well, I think, firstly, I'm going to defend forecasters slightly because a lot of the time a forecaster will give a very good forecast but of bad weather, and because people don't want to hear about bad weather, they end up giving the forecaster stick. He may be dead on about the 60 mile an hour winds and the rain and the sleet, but that's not what people want to hear, so inevitably they're going to be unhappy about that. But it's very difficult because the atmosphere is a chaotic system, and it's an incredibly complex system, and it's linked to the ocean, and it's linked to outer space, and it's linked to ice in Antarctica, and it's linked to the jungles in the Amazon. And trying to model that system accurately is effectively, well, we do a pretty good job, but it's effectively impossible to model it completely, so we're always going to make mistakes. And if you imagine when you're running a model, if you make a mistake early on, that error gets compounded over time, almost a bit like the butterfly effect. So if you're trying to position a storm and you're slightly wrong to start with, you're going to be very wrong by the time you're 5 days on. So effectively, any errors you make when you're modeling the weather get amplified over time. So when you get too far out, when you get too many days in advance, your mistakes are going to be so large that your forecast is going to be quite significantly wrong.
Ah, it all makes sense. Right, well, could you give us a brief little forecast for what we've got coming up this week and explain how you're doing it?
Yeah, so as many of you will have noticed today, it's a very nice day. It's warm and it's sunny, slightly fresher than it was feeling yesterday. And that's because we've got a ridge of high pressure that's just built in from the Atlantic. Unfortunately, it's turning downhill again tomorrow as weather fronts sweep in again from the west. So
what is a weather front?
What is a weather front?
Yeah, basic question, but I've always wanted to know.
Okay, yeah, weather front.
And does weather have a back?
No, weather does not have a back. It's always forward looking, I'm afraid. Although fronts can go backwards, which is kind of confusing.
Ooh.
But a weather front is just, it's the dividing line between two different air masses. So an air mass is a body of atmosphere, a body of air that has a particular temperature and humidity, and a weather front will separate two different ones, because actually air doesn't want to mix. If it's a different temperature and a different humidity, it doesn't mix very readily with other parcels of air. So the weather front is what will separate them. So you may have cold, dry air on one side and warm, moist air on the other side, and in between the two there'll be a weather front. And because where those two air masses meet,
they're just not getting along.
Well, exactly. The warm air is forced up by the cold air, and wherever you have ascent, you get
warm air rises
exactly,
and cold air
so you get ascent, you get clouds, you get moisture, you get rain, and often you get wind as well. So that's what a weather front is. But anyway, yes, so back to my forecast before you rudely interrupted me. Yes, so weather front sweeping in from the west on Sunday, so everywhere we'll see some rain.
So is this a high pressure weather front or a low pressure weather front?
Well, a weather front just separates two air masses, but usually high pressure will tend to weaken the effects of weather fronts because high pressure, you effectively have downward moving air. That's why the pressure becomes high at the surface.
Uh-huh.
And that downward moving air cancels out the ascent that you need to build your front. So it tends to dampen out the effects of the front, and you get less rain and less cloud. Yeah, so the front's moving in from the west, bringing some rain, but probably least rain to the London area and southeast of England, which will
good.
Be
always
good for
nice.
The masses to know. And then into next week, high pressure rebuilds and on Monday and on Tuesday. And by Tuesday we pick up a southerly flow, so it could become very warm, even hot, and then by Wednesday we pick up a southeasterly flow, so that's when our air comes from France, from the south of France and from Italy and the Mediterranean. That could bring some really hot and dry, potentially very sunny weather as well. So it looks like perhaps by next Wednesday we could be hitting the magical 30 degree mark, so time
amazing.
To crack out your shorts, your sun cream, and get that barbecue
ready.
We
will literally be having the south of France in London.
Well, yeah, it will be great if that does come off, but as I say, that's 5 days out, all could change, but for the moment it's looking odds on for some pretty hot weather coming our way.
Brilliant. Oh, well, we are running out of time, but before we go, I asked you at the top of the show, how will you be spending your leap second on Wednesday the 30th of June at midnight? We will be having a leap second, and this is because atomic clocks are too accurate, and as the Earth is orbiting the Sun, it's actually slowing down very, very, very tiny amounts, and therefore the atomic clocks need to add an extra second every now and then just to keep in line with the Earth's orbit. So there'll be a leap second. And before we actually get your answer, Matthew, Anna, have we had any listeners tweet in how they'll be spending their leap second?
We've had a couple. The general gist, everyone seems to want to spend extra time in bed. Bed or sleeping seems to be the most popular so far.
Yep.
We've also had a couple of people called Team Tobermory for crying. They're obviously training for some event. They will obviously be spending their extra second training.
Those guys really piss me off, actually. They keep spamming all my social media feeds.
Yeah, some Artemis quadrathlon thing. What is that?
What even is that?
And Anna, how will you be spending it yourself?
I've been thinking about this quite hard over the course of the hours. I've been trying to kind of tweet as well. But I was thinking about my friend who, he started this thing of filming a second of every day. And I thought maybe I'll start off doing that for a year.
Yeah, that's an app, that's isn't it? And then you can put them all together and it's, you've got like a really nice kind of second of years in a little film. To give people some inspiration, here are some facts from The New Scientist. In just 1 second, 11 trees are cut down in the Amazon. The Large Hadron Collider collects 1 petabyte of data. That is a one with 15 zeros after it. A million only has 6 zeros, so I didn't even know what number that is, but a petabyte of data. The International Space Station travels 7,700 meters in orbit around the Earth. And the fastest enzyme in the world, carbonic anhydrase, catalyzes 600,000 reactions. So if you think you've got a busy job, just think about that poor little enzyme.
And Lewis Hamilton can have all his tyres changed. What was that?
That was 1.8 seconds.
Thank you, Graham Norton.
Half of his tyres changed. Matthew, what will you be doing?
I've been thinking long and hard about this, and I've decided I'm going to have a good blink.
A blink?
Yeah, a nice old blink.
Very nice. And I'm just going to be very unoriginal, and I might do a little leap. Leap on the leap second.
That sounds rubbish. You're so lame.
And also, I just thought I'd highlight this because I got very excited about it. On Sunday at 10:30 on BBC One, David Attenborough will be in conversation with Barack Obama.
Oh, I've heard snippets from him on the radio.
Telling him how
really
we can
cool.
save the planet. I mean, I love David Attenborough, quite like Obama. I think everyone should tune in. It's going to be great.
What's the bet that population growth is going to be in there?
Yeah, I mean, I did see David
Attenborough. Pet hate of David's.
I saw him talk once. Yeah, Sir David. And he did say the number one thing we need to do is limit our population growth. Or... anyway, so leaving you with those and with our final song. What's our final song going to be, Matthew?
Our final song is Knocked Up by Kings of Leon. And I first heard this at my first ever music festival when I was young. I was 17 years old and I was at Oxygen in Ireland. I think it's County Kildare, and it absolutely blew me away. It's quite slow, but a very, very amazing song.
Indeed it is. I have learned so much today. Thank you for
Yeah, well, thanks for having
show.
Me. It's been great fun. Maybe I'll come back sometime.
Yeah, I hope you do. Or maybe you could do a weekly weather forecast.
And thanks to our awesome producer, Anna Regulin.
Yeah, thank you. Keeping us updated on the Twitter. You've been seeing her fantastic work. And it's time for me to say goodbye for another week. So
thanks for listening, everyone. Goodbye.
Bye.